This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, Vice President of Security Technology at Synopsys and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Synopsys and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.synopsys.com/silverbullet. This is the 152nd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have today with me Elias Levy. Hi, Elias.
Hey, how you doing?
Elias Levy, a.k.a. Aleph One, is a distinguished engineer in Cisco's security business group, where he works on big data and cloud technologies in support of endpoint security. Previously, he was senior technical director for Symantec's Security Technology and Response Organization. He was also CTO of Security Focus in the late 90s. Elias was the moderator of the mailing list Bug Track from May 1996 until he stepped down in October 2001, and he was the author of Smashing the Stack for Fun and Profit, which was published in FRAC 49. Elias served as department editor for IEEE S&P Magazine's Attack Trends and Malware Recon departments. He's also an avid scuba diver, and he lives in the Bay Area in California with his family. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I noticed you must have done some intel if you found a scuba diving tank.
Actually, I got something to ask you about that. So if you'll forgive me, I have to start with possibly your most famous work of all. Is that okay?
Sure.
So when did you take that picture of a great white shark that pervades the internet?
That was probably about 5 years ago. It was on a dive trip I did to Guadalupe Island, which is off the coast of Mexico, mm-hmm. about where Ensenada is. And it was a cage diving specifically to go see in Great White. And it was just a great boat. You know, they have a couple of cages right behind the boat,
yep.
So you can just slip in. But those are right at the surface. And so they got a couple of... they call them wranglers on each side of the boat that have tuna tails on ropes and with floaters. So they throw this thing out there to try to get the shark a little bit closer to you.
Wow!
And that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
But then they have on the side of the boat they have a winch, and attached to the winch they have a cage that can go down about 30 feet.
Awesome.
So that one's great. It's essentially an elevator. So you get in that thing, and for that particular photo, I kind of sort of climbed towards the top of the cage and kind of got my camera out above it, and we just had this great beautiful shark going above the cage and the silhouette. So
it's a phenomenal picture, and what's funny is if you look in, like, I don't know, nature publications and diving publications, you'll see this great picture of a shark and it has you as the photographer, so you're
yeah,
credited all over the place with that.
It's pretty popular. It's funny, you know, because I just put them out, you know, with the right Creative Commons copyright, and of course, and everybody's just looking for, you know, something to add to the article, and shark comes across it.
That's great. So, all right, let's talk about computer security, I guess. So, you've been in security for a long, long time, way over 25 years. So, what got you started in computer security in the first place?
It's a good question, and in some ways, I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I was definitely interested in computers as a kid, although probably unlike a lot of people in the industry, I had a pretty late start. I was not born in the U.S. I was born in Venezuela, and you know, even though we did have some computers personally, I didn't really have one until I was maybe 16,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which I badgered my mother for about a year until she got me one. And, you know, as luck would have it, what she got me was an Apple IIgs.
Of course.
Which was kind of like at the end of the line for that particular type of computer.
Yeah, I got a 2+, but I think a few years before you got your GS.
And, you know, this was, you know, back in Venezuela, as far as I knew, there was no BBSs. I knew no one else with an Apple IIgs. and I had no software. So I could do very little with it. The one great thing about those old computers, right, is if you just let them boot with no disk in them, you end up with usually a basic interpreter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was the first thing I learned.
Yeah.
But so it wasn't really until I moved to the U.S. for university that I really had a lot more access and became more interested. And it's hard to tell what was the initial thing, but it was about that time that I started reading The Cuckoo's Egg by Cliff Stoll.
Yep.
And Cyberpunk by Markov. And, you know, that kind of one thing led to another, and started doing research. I remember spending a lot of time at the library in the microfilm section, just looking up old articles. Actually dug out the old Esquire article on the Blue Box and Captain Crunch.
Oh, yeah, wow.
And you know, at one point I, you know, learned of 2600. You know, Santa Monica had a place where you could buy them, so I ended up getting a copy. And I was lucky enough that I think the first copy I had was the one where they had instructions on how to do a red box.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked that up and decided to try to make one. So I walked down to my local Radio Shack, and, you know, obviously you have to order the particular crystal to make the modification, and it's a kind of very specific part. And as I'm at the store, there's actually another couple of odd-looking characters in there as well. And as I walk out of the store, they're actually waiting for me. and the guys are like, so...
What are you going to do with those crystals? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm building this thing. It's a red box. And they're like, oh, we're building the blue box. So, those two folks happen to be a couple of local enthusiasts of security, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And they actually gave me the number for a local, a very famous hacker BBS. Mm-hmm. Called Lunatic Labs, had been around for a very long time, and that just opens you know, many doors to other things. So that was kind of my introduction to the whole thing.
Wow, what year was that?
That was probably 92, I would say.
92, cool.
Yeah,
I know you did some work later with Mudge and some of the other guys from the Lost Loft. Did you work with those guys?
Mostly. I mean, we definitely knew each other. You know, Mudge in particular was a pretty prolific researcher.
Yep.
You know, especially around the time the whole buffer overflow stuff was coming out, there were a number of people that were releasing working papers about the stuff they were doing. And so when it came time for me to write that article on Frack on buffer overflows, which I can't remember if Ralph Demon 9 from that was editor of Frack at the time, mm-hmm. whether I pitched to him or he asked me to write something. But in any case, and that you know, it was some of his stuff and Red Dragon and other people that I was sort of bothering. So it all ended up being in the mix, and that resulted in that article.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you about that super famous article. So that was Frack 49, and it was published November 8th, 1996. So it just turned 22, which means that it's old enough to drink on its own in most states. So the article kind of provided this step-by-step introduction to stack buffer overflows for people who don't know that. You told us a little bit about the backstory, but you pitched it to them, or did they come and get you and say, we need something? And were you surprised by how quickly it took off?
To the former question, I can't really recall. I mean, it's been such a long time.
Yeah.
You know, Demon 9 Route, he was local to the area, so we kind of knew each other. So, and then kind of recall how that went down. But as to the later, I have to say, I am surprised at how sort of popular and influential and widely quoted it ended up being.
Yeah. I mean, zeitgeist. It was just the perfect time to publish that.
It was. I mean, in some ways, I mean, and actually not in some ways, in all the ways. I mean, the article was really just an exercise of me trying to understand those types of vulnerabilities, given the available information.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was really doing it for myself, and just happened to end up being an article on
Friday. Well, that's the way most science actually progresses, turns out.
So, well, and I mean, looking back at it, that's probably one of the reasons it was so popular, right? Because it really walks you through the progression of understanding, okay, this is the memory model, these are things are laid out in memory, and then step by step on, you know, how do you build all these things, how do you make them more complex, how do you make them more reliable for this particular type of buffer overflow. And, you know, I guess anyone that needs to learn about it, that's the same progression that you go through. So I think that's probably why it was so popular.
Yeah. So, you know, it turns out you were working on software security well before it was even a field. So when Viega and I referenced and extended your work in building secure software, that was 2001. So, you know, 5 years later, it was still super important. Do you think we've been making sufficient progress in software security in the last 25 years?
You know, I am actually somewhat optimistic, which is something pretty rare for me to say.
No, I am too. I'm with you.
I'm actually tend to be not that much of an optimist in general. So I think so. I mean, if you look at specific areas like, protections being developed in operating systems that are systematic, architecture from an architecture point of view, things like the work that has been done in web browsers, new languages that are being developed that are more immune to certain types of vulnerabilities, like whether it's Golang or Rust, and their more wider adoption, and more secure platforms like iOS, or even some of the changes being done and more general operating systems like Windows and Mac to make them a little bit more locked down. I think in general, I am optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not to say there's no perfect solution. But you know, if you see the exploits nowadays, they have to jump through so many hoops to make them work. And it's incredible that they still do.
Yeah, I know.
And in some ways, it shows that, you know, someone that with enough resources still will be able to get through. But definitely the low-hanging fruit has kind of been cleared away in many cases.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm really glad I wrote Exploiting Software in 2004 and not, say, last year.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it was a lot easier to do back then.
That right. Exploits now, I mean, they're geniuses, right? I mean, the amount of work that goes into them is incredible. I'd rather not be doing that now.
So since 1996, as you mentioned, we've seen better programming language, better operating systems, better technology for finding bugs in terrible languages like C and C++. Static analysis tools, for example, actually work and are widely available commercially. So what's your opinion on tools for finding problems in pervasive but broken programming languages versus fixing the programming languages themselves?
I'm definitely in the later camp. I mean, knock on wood, I haven't had to write any C++ in over a decade, I think.
So maybe it'll die ever, all by itself.
Yeah. So if I don't ever have to do that again, I'll be happy. So the more it gets baked into the languages and the frameworks and the architectures, the better that it will definitely be.
Yep.
Obviously, there's still a large number of older software out there, and this stuff still gets taught in universities and it's still used in many shops.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be around for a long time. So those other tools are still required.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the way forward is on new languages, new platforms, new frameworks.
Yeah, I agree with you. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, make sure to check out my other projects on GaryMcGraw.com. There you can find writings, videos, and even original music. So, For the record, I also agree with you that the only way to really understand computer security is to talk explicitly about exploits and attacks, which in your early days you really did a lot of. So back when you were moderating BugTrack, you took an active role in the full disclosure debate, and then chaos ensued. And, you know, what's your view of that whole debacle or debate or whatever you want to call it these days?
You know, that's one of the discussions I hate the most.
Yeah, I hate it too, but I think it should be dead. I mean, it's obvious to me we have to publish that stuff. So
yeah, I mean, I hate it in some ways because there's no really easy answer. So reasonable people can potentially come to different conclusions about at least some of the nuances regarding disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the other thing too is, you know, I was obviously, I guess you would call it the forefront of those discussions when I was moderating BugTrack.
Oh, absolutely. We used BugTrack to publish all the stuff about the Java security errors back in the 90s, and then a whole bunch of the, you know, when Microsoft tried to do StackGuard and got it wrong, BugTrack was the place we turned for that.
Yeah, correct. And I think I wrote a bunch of editorials on the subject to it at some point, maybe in Security Focus or elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this definitely is something that I've advocated. At the same time, I don't necessarily consider myself an absolutist on the subject. I understand that people that necessarily argue for some restraint are doing so because they also want to protect users from the worst of the impact of those particular policies.
Mm-hmm.
So things like, you know, do you give people enough time to fix something, or do you need to release an exploit right away? You know, those are things that are more nuanced. But if you have to choose one side, certainly the side to choose is the one where you disclose any information.
Because people have to learn how to not do that.
People have to learn, right? Yeah. So you can only improve things in the long term if you share information.
Yep.
If you do not make it available, then you do not learn from your own or from other mistakes. And at the end of the day, that was the reason why BugTrack was created, because back in the day, everything was kept secret, and the vendors patched things silently, or they didn't patch them at all, and CERT released, you know, this, you know, one paragraph advisory that didn't really tell you anything about anything.
Right.
So it was kind of the dark days, the dark times, and border disclosure was kind of a fresh light into that darkness. And I think it accelerated me things. It accelerated good things and accelerated bad things. But hopefully over the long term, the good overwhelms the bad and things become better.
Right. So along with our friend, our mutual friend, Yvonne Arce, you published a very interesting column in IEEE S&P bringing some security street smarts, if you want to call it that, to the science community. So what was your favorite column back in that body of work?
Oh, my God. Jesus. That was such a long time ago.
I'm making you think. That was only 10 years ago, man. We've fast-forwarded 15 years.
Kind of hard to tell.
I mean, look, all right, let's set it up a little more. So S&P at the time was really about kind of academic computer security. There wasn't much about exploits or attacks or even thinking about things like disclosure, malware, and you guys changed that for the better, I think. So, you know, what do you have to say about that in general?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that's definitely something that was needed in our particular industry or I guess the area of study. All too often, research tends to be kind of a ivory tower sort of research, so that doesn't really end up being applicable to the real world, or it's looking at very esoteric problems when maybe the problems that we have in the field are actually a lot more mundane. So if from that sense, you know, seeing what actually happening in the streets, as you call them, especially, you know, the magazine is audience tends to be more research oriented, mm-hmm. probably bringing to them some information that they wouldn't know otherwise. You know, one that I always connect, you know, it's not related to anything that we wrote and me and Ivan wrote about, but one that I've seen over and over 20 years is kind of anomaly detection systems,
right.
You know, researchers just love. I mean, this paper after paper after paper on anomaly system, and I've yet to see a single serious, commercial product that's been successful as an anomaly detection system.
Exactly.
Because at the end of the day, they generate way too many alerts.
And if you're an attacker, the best thing to do is just to set off alerts in sector 4 and attack in sector 2 or whatever.
Right. So when you're actually looking at products to get fielded, customers have way too many alerts already. They don't need something else that tells them something is suspicious. They need an alert that tells them something is bad.
Yep.
They need some level of certainty. So from a commercial perspective, anomaly has always been a big flop. And I think that's something that has seemed to really penetrate in the academic sort of research area.
Yeah, although there are zillions of publications in the academic research area, so you're right.
Oh God, I mean, you can go back, 30 years, and you'll have a mountain of research papers to read.
Yeah, I think some of the first was Teresa Lunt's work in the early 90s. So you hold 6 patents, which is kind of interesting for a full disclosure kind of guy. So tell us a little bit about the trajectory patent that you have and its relationship to inventory and computer security and knowing what you have and what it's doing.
Sure. I mean, that one kind of relates to similar work that we did first at SourceFire and at Cisco for kind of our endpoint security product, which is endpoint detection and response product, which is basically a product that allows you to record activities at an endpoint to hopefully detect, but if not, at least help you remediate an endpoint after a breach. And so, I've always been kind of a jack of all trades, really have spent very little time specialized in any one area. But one area that's kind of always been of interest to me has been visualizations.
Right.
And so that particular patent revolves around some of the visualizations that we end up developing or that I developed for the Cisco AMP product. And the idea is to help responders easily see what the interactions between processes were inside an endpoint to more easily pinpoint the activities that an attacker performed there.
Mm-hmm. And so can you draw some sort of relationship to this notion of inventory or knowing what you have or knowing what you're running? Or am I just crazy?
No, it's definitely a key feature of any product. You need to be able to figure out what is it that you're running in your environment, because it's the only way you're going to be able to figure out what is new in it, and therefore what actually you should be focusing on. So, any security product in many ways is just a filter. You need to be able to ignore everything that is normal, everything that is non-malicious, and then being able to focus down on what it actually shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
And inventory is one of the ways to do that. Now, most products that have tried to go down the sort of whitelisting route, where your inventory systems and then whitelist and then you flag anything that, or stop anything else from running, unless you have a very locked down environment, they don't tend to work very well, because obviously users need to get their job done. That usually involves downloading other files per your job.
Well, yeah, we invented these things called virtual machines that you can run anything on. So as long as you have permission to run a Turing complete computer on your computer, you can't lock it down anymore. Whatever.
So because management management impossibility to do whitelist everything or go with a whitelist only approach. So usually it's some sort of hybrid, right? So you inventory what you can. You allow users the flexibility to do what they want to do without getting in their way. But then use that sort of inventory to filter what is known and then allow the responder to focus on what's unknown or suspicious.
Okay, something completely different. So in my view, you're kind of an artist at heart with interest in photography and music and acting. So does artistic mindset and having a knack for art help in a field like computer security these days?
Well, yeah, I guess it depends on what your role is. But yeah, I mean, having an imagination is really what it boils down to, right? You need to be creative, have creative thoughts. Certainly your attackers are creative, so you need to be able to match them so as to try to figure out what it is they're doing.
So here's a total flyer, and I'm only going to give you 1 minute to answer this. So what will computer security look like in 25 years?
Well, I think probably a lock like your iPhone. I think it's going to keep getting more locked down, and it's going to be more of a walled garden. And many ways it's going to be good, and a lot of ways, especially for people like us that really love messing around with computers, it's not going to be that great.
So more walled garden Apple AOL approaches?
Pretty much, yeah.
Great. Thanks a lot, man. So what is your favorite place to scuba dive?
Oh, man. That would probably be almost anywhere in the Philippines or Indonesia. Like Raja Ampat in Indonesia, by close to Papua New Guinea, is just awesome.
What's so great over there? I haven't been over there yet.
Well, Raja Ampat in particular, you get a little bit of everything. I mean, the Philippines, Indonesia are well known for their kind of strange small creatures. So if you are into macro photography, it's just wonderful. You got coral, you got muck dives where you actually dive in the mud looking for little things to pop out. But they also have big stuff. You got places where you got sharks, in Raja Ampat, you got places with manta rays. So if you get on a liveaboard, so you get on a boat and then you go from island to island and you wake up, you're on a new island and you do your 3 or 4 or 5 dives a day and then have a good meal, wake up next morning and do it again.
Cool. Well, hey, thanks. This has been a fun conversation. I really appreciate your participating.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Synopsys, an IEEE Security and Privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October issue of IEEE S&P magazine is a special issue devoted to post-quantum cryptography. The issue features our interview with Tanya Janka from Microsoft. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.synopsys.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.